From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Action-packed program for you tonight. Next hour, Angels, out-of-body experiences, NETs. Later on tonight, open lines as well. Here's what's happening. Canadian authorities said that they were unable to identify the person whose foot was found last year in a blue sock and a gray Nike sneaker that washed up on shore on Vancouver's shoreline. The foot, which was discovered back in September of 2018, is the 15th time in just over a decade that a human foot was discovered on the British Columbia shoreline. More than half of those feet were determined to have belonged to people who either died by accident or committed suicide, while the remaining third remain unidentified, according to the British Columbia sources. Strange story. A Brooklyn jury has found that Mexican kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman guilty of running a massive, violent drug trafficking operation that ran for decades and pumped billions of dollars worth of drugs into the United States. The drug lord looked stunned as the panel handed down the verdict on its sixth day of deliberations. It went long, convicting him on all counts, including operating a continuing criminal enterprise, use of firearms, and various charges of conspiracy to import and distribute cocaine, heroin, and marijuana. He will be gone for the rest of his life. Some red flags emerged for the U.S. economy late last year as credit card inquiries fell, student loan delinquencies remain high, and riskier borrowers drove home automobiles on their own, according to a report that could signal a downturn is on the horizon. As we reported yesterday, the Iowa Democratic Party has laid out a proposal that would add a major change to its presidential caucuses, allowing for absentee voting by phone on six different days through virtual caucuses using smartphones. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet, with us. I'm not sure about voting by smartphone, Lauren. What do you think?
Yeah, well, we've talked a lot in the past about how dangerous e-voting is, and especially internet voting. I mean, really, the entities that support these are usually either the firms trying to sell the systems or people affiliated with the systems or hackers who would love to invisibly change election results. This particular case with the Iowa Democratic Party is a little bit different. First off, it is related to caucuses, mm-hmm. which are unusual to start with compared with straight votes, because you have people meeting in person. So what they're trying to do here is have a remote option that goes above and beyond the normal caucus framework that they'd be using. And it looks like they've built it in a pretty limited way. What they're doing is the virtual caucuses would be like an additional county in each congressional district, and they would only represent 10% of each district's representation at the state convention where they actually, you know, pick candidates. And the traditional caucus format would still be used. The traditional caucuses would still be used to determine the delegates awarded and not the overall count in the districts. So what they're really doing here is trying to expand the participation a bit, but they've done it in a way where if it goes through, it is still a proposal. There's like a 30-day public comment period that's running, that just got started, I guess. If they do it the way the proposal says, it's set up in a way where it's limited so that I don't think it could significantly skew the results, even if something went really wacky with the virtual portion of it, like if it was hacked or something. It's still a relatively small part of the overall process. It's not really what we think about when we usually think about e-voting and internet voting, where it's a straight, you know, one-to-one vote, and you picture somebody getting into the system and changing enough votes in enough states, for example, to pick a different president, and you wouldn't even know it if there's no paper trail, for example.
Good point. Lauren, let's keep our eyes on this one. I don't like smartphone voting, even though it seems to be convenient. It's dangerous. California Governor Gavin Newsom has announced he's pulling the plug on the state's massive high-speed rail project from Los Angeles to San Francisco that was more than a decade behind schedule and billions of dollars in the red. It was a waste of money. Well, Doc Wallach is right from criticalhealthnews.com. The quick and easy sandwiches you love are chipping away at your mortality one nibble at a time, according to new research from France. we face a 14% higher risk of early death with each 10% increase in the amount of ultra-processed foods that we eat. NASA scientists have spotted a giant crater beneath Greenland's ice that may be the result of a massive meteorite smashing into the planet. The crater, which is just over 22 miles wide, would be one of the largest meteorite impact sites on Earth if it's proved to be the result of a space rock. The crater is buried under more than a mile of ice. Yellowstone volcano, the caldera, has erupted three times in history, 2.1 million years ago, 1.2 million years ago, and 640,000 years ago. And scientists have previously revealed, should an earthquake occur, it could take less than 2 weeks before a catastrophic reaction event with the potential to wipe out three-quarters of the United States is triggered. And you know what? It's overdue. Let's check in with our expert, Stan Dale. Stan, this is a scary story.
It is. However, if you read the UK news, there's a volcanologist over there that says that our guys are getting excited too early, and it's going to be way out, you know, not next month or next year even. It's hard to know because there are 150 seismometers measuring or monitoring the whole Yellowstone caldera. And we know that they've had them there for 4 years, and supercomputers tied into them to watch it. Now, somebody thinks it's worth using a lot of compute power to monitor Yellowstone. So I'm not going to say positively it ain't happening, but the USGS at this moment officially says that it's not going to erupt. The water that makes the steam in the geysers, however, is being superheated to about 345 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's increasing, but that's up in the shallow part of the crust, and the magma pool that would do the eruption is 400 miles down. So, you know, I think we rest easy on that and just let the experts yell at each other.
But if it does go, it's going to be a disaster, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's going to hit Colorado, Montana, Wyoming. It's going to put, you know, deep ash. It's going to have magma flows around the area. It won't be pleasant.
Stan's website is his name, Stan Deyo, DEYO.com. Thank you, Stan. The Internal Revenue Service has accumulated a backlog of 5 million unsorted pieces of mail during the five-week government shutdown, according to an agency watchdog report. The National Taxpayer Advocate, an independent organization within the IRS, delivered an annual report to Congress that painted a dismal picture of the federal tax collector as already stretched thin. In a moment, Daniel Pilla back with us on Coast to Coast, how to get tax amnesty, and he will talk with us about the IRS next on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast. For more than three decades, Daniel Pilla has been the nation's leader in taxpayers' rights defense and IRS abuse prevention and cure. Regarded as one of the country's premier experts in IRS procedures and general financial problems resolution techniques, he has helped hundreds of thousands of people solve personal and business tax and financial problems. And it's that time of year coming up. Dan Pilla back with us on Coast to Coast. Hello, Daniel. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, George. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. So they tell us the shutdown has really backed things up at the IRS. Is it that bad?
Yeah, there's no question about it. It was that bad before they shut down.
Yeah.
You know, the IRS is dealing with millions of pieces of correspondence every year. And the fact of the matter is that they can't handle it the way it is. With the shutdown, everything piled up, of course, and backlogged in mailrooms across the country. And so, you know, now the question is, how are they working their way through the stuff? You know, one of the questions that I posed early in the shutdown process is, are they going to clear out the correspondence by just throwing it all in the trash? You know, that's what we don't know, and of course, there'd be no way to know that.
Well, that's a good point. Now, tell us, how did you get started in this kind of industry, Dan?
Well, I got started with this with tax resolution work as a result of problems my father had with the IRS in the early part of the 1970s. He got behind on his employees withholding taxes. He had a small business here in our hometown of St. Paul, Minnesota. Got behind on his employees withholding taxes, and in 1974, the IRS padlocked his shop and auctioned his equipment off for a couple cents on the dollar. And then later on, in the later part of the 1970s, they turned their attention to our family home and tried to seize and sell it for the back tax liability. And that's when I got started, George. It was just a matter of desperation trying to help the family solve that problem.
You were 18 years old, and you did help them, didn't you?
Yeah, what happened is I came home one day, and my mom was sitting at the table with an envelope in her hand from the IRS, and she hands me this letter, and she says, "What do you make of this?" And I read it, and I said, "Well, it looks like they're going to try to seize the house." And she says, "Well, what do we do about it?" Well, of course, at 18, I didn't know what to do. But what I did do is I went over to the local law school library, and I started fumbling around in the Internal Revenue Code, and I didn't even know what I was looking for, but I was fumbling around in the tax code, and I literally stumbled onto an area of the tax code that deals with taxpayers' rights issues and limits the power of the IRS. And so I started reading in this code section, and I didn't get six pages into it, George, and discovered that the IRS was proceeding illegally to seize that home. And so I did what any 18-year-old would do under the circumstances. I sued the IRS. I pasted together a little lawsuit, and I filed it against the IRS. And a couple of months later, found myself in a courtroom in Minneapolis, a federal courtroom in front of a judge. And the IRS had flown an attorney in from the Justice Department at that point, from Washington, to try to have my case thrown out. And I stood there in front of the judge, and I said, "Look, Judge, the law says this, and the IRS is doing something different, and they shouldn't be allowed to get away with it." And that was about it. My argument was about that polished. And I sat down, and the Justice Department attorney stood up, and he started blathering things and court cases this and statutes that, and he was carrying on with this stuff. And I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. I'm not sure he did either. But when he was finished, the judge looked over at him and pointed at me and said, "He's right." And he slammed the gavel, and I thought, well, this is easy. And so, you know, it was sort of an instant practice, because what happened is in between the time that my father got himself in trouble with the IRS and the day that I was in that courtroom in Minneapolis, he also then got involved with the so-called tax protester movement. These are the folks that believe that the tax laws are unconstitutional and they're voluntary and they don't apply to U.S. citizens. And you know, you've heard all these various arguments. Well, you know, people get drawn to these arguments precisely because they're desperate, in need of some kind of a tax solution. And these arguments hold out some hope, however faint that hope may be, but they hold out some hope for folks that are otherwise hopeless. And so people gravitate to the arguments looking for some kind of resolution, some kind of a hope of solution. Well, you know, the courtroom was packed that day with my dad's tax protester buddies. There must have been 100 or so folks in the courtroom. Most of them were my dad's friends who also had tax problems. And they saw the judge slam the gavel, and they saw the judge shut down the IRS. And so by the time I got home to my mother's house, they were lined up at the door.
Wow.
And it was an instant practice, George. And they said, "You know, can you help me with my tax problem?" I said, "Sure, I'm undefeated here. Let's go."
And you're still helping people.
And I'm helping people still to this day, yeah.
Why don't we do away with the IRS and just go to a use tax or something like that, a fair tax?
Well, that's a good question. And in fact, I've written quite extensively about the desirability of doing that. In fact, I wrote the first legislative proposal back in the early 1990s to abolish the IRS and adopt a national retail sales tax as the alternative. And it is a far better alternative, George, than what we have now. There is just no question about it. But the reason we don't adopt it is because the Congress likes the tax laws just the way they are. They like the tax laws complicated. They like the tax laws confusing. They like the tax laws to be oppressive for a number of reasons, not just about getting money. Sure, the tax laws are about getting money. That's undeniable. But the fact of the matter is that the Congress uses the tax laws for more than just getting money. They buy and sell legislative favors using the tax laws as currency. But even beyond that, George, they use the tax laws to pick winners and losers in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what our tax laws have become more than anything else, is the means for Congress to pick economic winners and losers by giving favorable tax consideration to certain businesses or activities that do, you know, something that is considered to be favorable, and punishing those activities or businesses that are doing things that are out of favor somehow with the current intelligentsia. Well, the problem with that is the definition of what's acceptable or not acceptable changes every 2 years.
That's exactly right. What's going on with these robocalls that so many people around the country, Dan, are getting, these robotic phone calls from what claims to be the IRS, Social Security, that there's a problem, you need to send us a check. What's going on there?
Well, it's absolute fraud, George. There's a whole generation of fraudulent activities that are going on now in this high-tech age, and what's happening is you've got this generation of fraudsters, scamsters that are using technology to make these phone calls on, as you say, robotic phone calls. And what happens is when you get on the phone with some of these people, you know, they've got a very distinct foreign accent, typically an Indian type accent.
Yep.
They're telling you in broken English, in very poor syntax, that you've got some kind of a problem with the Department of Revenue of Internal Services of the United States. You know, it's just no proper syntax whatsoever, that you owe this money and that they're going to send some kind of a sheriff or law enforcement person out to arrest you that very day if you don't pay them, you know, X amount of $1,000 over the phone right now with some kind of a credit card or a debit card or even even gift card.
Now, how many people fall for that?
Well, that's the problem, is millions of people fall for it, and tens of millions of dollars have been bilked from people using this scam.
Oh.
Folks need to know, George, that the IRS is never going to call you on the phone in the first instance. Now, you may have a phone relationship with an IRS person if you're going through an audit, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unusual to have phone calls back and forth. But if your first contact with the IRS will never, never be over the phone, and they will never tell you that if you don't pay X dollars today, they're sending the sheriff out to arrest you. That is never going to happen. So any kind of a phone call that has any kind of those attributes is an absolute sham.
Wow, when it's happening. That's a good tip for people, because they're going to get these phone calls, and you know, it's going to scare the living daylights out of a lot of people.
Well, no question about it. And not only are they using phones, George, but they're using emails as well, where you know, you'll get an email from somebody purporting to be from the IRS, or an email purporting to be from the IRS itself, saying that you've got this delinquency and you've got to pay this tax right now or you're going to be sent off to jail. And that's another thing that people need to know. The IRS is never going to communicate with you via email. Even if you have an ongoing audit situation, or you're dealing with a collection situation that you know is legitimate contact with the IRS, it's not coming in the form of emails. They don't use emails to communicate with people.
You say that there are three steps to avoid disaster on tax day. What are they?
Well, when we're talking about the disaster of not having the money to pay your tax, which is what happens to about 3.5 to 5 million people every single year, George. They file their tax returns without. April 15th, let me rephrase that and say, come April 15th, they don't have the money to pay the tax they owe. So there's a couple of things you need to know about. First thing to do is, if you owe money to the IRS that you can't pay come tax day, don't fail to file the tax return. That's the first mistake that people will make.
Mm-hmm.
Is they'll fail to file the return because they say to themselves, well, I can't file a tax return without the money, and if I just get an extension, I'll have the money in a couple of months, then I'll be able to pay them. Well, unfortunately, they don't have the money in a couple of months. And so pretty soon that the extended deadline comes and goes, and they still haven't filed the tax return. And then what happens is, before long, then a year goes by, and now they're required to file the next tax return. They still haven't filed the previous tax return. And now they get themselves into this pattern of non-filing that goes on for years.
And that's the big problem. If you don't file, that's the illegality, isn't it?
Well, it certainly can be an illegality, no question about it. The simple failure to file a tax return is not illegal. There has to be some criminal intent. But if there's a protracted pattern of non-filing, that certainly can be elevated to the level of a criminal problem. But here's where the insult comes. There's a failure to file penalty, George, of up to 25% of the tax liability.
Wow.
So, you know, if you don't have the money to pay in the first instance, the IRS adds insult to injury with the 25% penalty, plus another 25% penalty for failure to pay the tax, plus the interest on top of that. So the typical tax bill can escalate quickly, you know, 200%, 300%, and 400%, depending on how old it is.
That's crazy.
Go ahead.
That's crazy.
Well, yeah, it is. It's insane. And so you avoid the failure to file penalty. Even if you don't have the money, you avoid the failure to file penalty by filing the tax return. So that's the first mistake to avoid, is don't fail to file the return, even if you don't have the money. What you can do, there's a couple of strategies you can use, And I talk about these in my book, How to Get Tax Amnesty. I lay this all out step by step in detail how to do this. The first step is one of the best kept secrets that the IRS has available is the fact that you can get an extension of time to pay your taxes. Now, just about everybody understands that there's an extension, a filing extension that's available. If you submit an extension of time to file your return on or before April 15th, that gives you 6 additional months to file the tax return. But you still have to pay the tax by April 15th.
Hold on for a second, Dan. We're at a break. We'll come back and talk more next on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, reincarnation, out-of-body experiences, and angels. This hour, Daniel Pilla talking about how to get tax amnesty. Well, Columbus, Ohio is our state show on May 11th, and the tickets are going out the window. And let's catch them before they land someplace else. But all you have to do is go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, click events at the top of the homepage, or in the revolving series of carousel pictures, you'll see the link right at the back end there. Columbus, Ohio, Lincoln Theater, May 11th. There's also a phone number, 614-469-0939. 614-469-0939. Then, of course, on July 27th, we'll be in the Miramar, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, Florida area at the Miramar Cultural Center, our live stage show there. Looking forward to that. You can get your tickets the same way or call 1-800-745-3000. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our guest is Dan Pilla. We'll take some of your phone calls with him. His website is taxhelponline.com. which we have linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. What did you think of the president's tax cuts? Did that do anything for anybody, Dan?
Well, yeah, George. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act will reduce taxes for about 80% of American citizens. That only the top 20% of income earners are going to see either no tax increase or an increase in their taxes. The bottom 80% will see a refund. Now, you know, we're seeing a bunch of news stories. Speaking of fake news stories you were talking about during your commercial breaks there, speaking of fake news stories, there's a lot of news out there about, you know, how people are getting reduced refunds and what a catastrophe the Jobs Act is because people are getting reduced refunds. Well, here's what they're not telling you, George. As soon as the Tax Act was passed, the IRS rewrote all of their wage withholding tables and distributed new withholding tables to all employers in January of 2018. So a year ago, employers started withholding at the new lower rates, and so the reason that people are getting reduced refunds is because they didn't pay in as much taxes to begin with. You only get a refund when you overpay your taxes, and the fact that you got a smaller refund means, in this case, that you didn't pay in as much as you otherwise would have. So what happened is people were getting their refunds in their paychecks every single month, and that's why we've got these reduced refunds going on. So it's just not true that the tax cuts has resulted in higher increases of taxes for people. It's just not true.
No, not at all. Let's take some calls here for you while we're watching the clock here, Daniel. Let's go to Dave in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi there.
I was wondering, is there an angle where it seems to me that they're confiscating wages from us just by the fact that we get up in the morning and have the incentive to go try to earn a wage to buy food and put clothes on our backs and carry on a life. And, you know, there's a thing called the 13th Amendment. And I don't see how they get away with it. I can see the use tax where I buy a gallon of gas to put in my car and they pull money out for road repairs and maintenance and that. But I just don't see how they get away with taking money from our paychecks.
Well, the answer, Dave, is you put your finger on the economic problem with the income tax. The income tax taxes the engine of economic growth, which is income and productivity and economic activity. You can't have sustained economic growth when you're taxing the engine that creates that growth. So from an economic standpoint, it's flawed policy to be taxing income. It's flawed policy to be taxing production. You should be taxing consumption instead. And that's why I am much in favor of a national retail sales tax over an income tax. The fact of the matter is the founding fathers never intended the government to be funded through an income tax. They intended the government to be funded through excise taxes, which a retail sales tax is an excise tax. And that's how they intended to do it for a lot of reasons. Chiefly, they never wanted the federal government to have its hands directly in the pockets of American citizens. And that's the advantage that an income tax has for the government. Now the federal government has a claim to look at the books and records and financial activities of every citizen without respect to whether there's any suspicion of any wrongdoing. The IRS doesn't have to allege that there's any criminal activity to conduct an audit against people. They just have to. They don't even need a reason. They can arbitrarily decide that they want to look at your records just because they want to look at your records, which is something the founders never intended the federal government to be able to do.
Interesting. They've got new spyware, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the IRS has got literally trillions of bits of information that is flowing into the agency every year, George. Just for example, this tax season, there's going to be about 3.6 billion information returns. We're talking about W-2s and 1099s
Jeez.
That are filed with the IRS. The IRS also has access to, of course, 152 million individual income tax returns, another 100 million business tax returns, several million more miscellaneous tax returns like trust returns and estate returns, those types of things. How does the IRS assimilate all of this data and put it into usable form? Well, they've contracted with a company out in California to build a software program. It's called the company is called Palantir Technologies, and think PayPal. That's who Palantir is. So it's a big data company that the IRS has contracted with, and will pay about $100 million to build this computer program, George, that will allow the IRS to assimilate all this data into a system that will give them the power to search it, analyze it, visualize data, interact with a wide variety of data sets so that users are going to be able to leverage that information to perform advanced analytics such as linking data together, detecting patterns, doing statistical analysis, even behavioral analysis, George, from the data patterns that they get in this information. And so the IRS is going to be using massive amounts of data now to track the activities of people. And we're not just talking about tax or financial information that you file with the IRS. We're talking about links to social media posts, emails, phone records,
wow,
bank records, credit cards, debit cards, the whole spectrum of data that the IRS has got access to, but at this point in time can't assimilate. Before long, they will be assimilating that into patterns that will aid them in selecting tax returns for audit and drilling deeper into people's lives than ever before.
Every year I have people on from the Fair Tax group, and every year they talk about how they'd love a fair tax, a sales tax, and it never happens.
Yeah. Well, and it doesn't happen because Congress doesn't want a simple tax system, George. Congress wants the IRS to be able to monitor every aspect of your private life. Congress wants a complicated tax system because in that way the IRS can effectively use its strategies of bluff and intimidation and misinformation and disinformation to get money from people they don't owe. That's why it's so important for your listeners to know what their rights are when they're dealing with the IRS, particularly if you've got a tax debt, if you're dealing with some kind of delinquency and you're facing wage levies or tax liens. You need to know how to deal with this stuff because otherwise you get run over in the process.
Good point. What is tax court?
Tax court is a branch of the federal government, for lack of a better word, a creation by Congress, a court creation by Congress that hears tax disputes exclusively. It's the tax equivalent of the bankruptcy courts, George. Bankruptcy courts are set up strictly to hear bankruptcy cases.
Mm-hmm.
No other kind of a case goes into the bankruptcy courts. The tax court is the same way. It's a federal court which is set up specifically to hear tax cases and nothing else.
Let's go to Kevin in Indianapolis, first-time caller. Hi, Kev. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How's it going, buddy?
Okay, my friend. Thank you.
Hey, I was just I'm a truck driver, and I was been driving for like 38 years, and they would let us claim road expenses every year on our taxes. You know, when I first started, it was like $15 a day. And if you was out for 250 days, whatever that came up to, you can deduct that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they no longer do that. Last year was the last year for it, and it used to, it was up to around $50 a day last year that you could deduct. But you can't, only way you can do it now is if you're an owner-operator, if you own your own truck. Well, you can do that anyway before. It's like a business.
Yeah, well, what you're talking about, Kevin, is one of the provisions of the Jobs Act that suspended the what they call the miscellaneous unreimbursed employee business expenses. So people who work for a company as an employee that incurred expenses in working for the company that were not reimbursed by the company were able to deduct those on their tax returns. The Jobs Act eliminated that. However, on balance, what the Jobs Act also did is it doubled your standard deduction. So for a married filing jointly taxpayer, it went from about $12,000 a year to $24,000. So depending on the facts and circumstances of your case, it is often true, and not across the board, but it's often true that the increased standard deduction overcomes the fact that you lost your itemized deductions.
It's supposed to, but it doesn't in all cases,
well,
does it?
That's exactly right. It won't in all cases. That's true.
Let's go next to Joel in Miami, Florida. Nope, he's not ready yet. The negotiating with the IRS, can you do that? Work out plans to pay?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, George. In fact, that's the heart and soul of the book, How to Get Tax Amnesty, is how to negotiate settlements with the IRS. And in the book, I talk about the negotiation of installment agreements, for example, which is something that the IRS doesn't talk about. But the fact of the matter is, if you've got a tax delinquency with the IRS and they're threatening levy, you can avoid those levies by engaging in an installment agreement negotiation. And in fact, one of the strategies I talk about in the book will act as a virtual injunction against the IRS from enforcing levies or seizures against any property when you start to engage that negotiation process for an installment agreement. It legally shuts them down from enforcement action.
I mean, if you admit, I owe the tax, I just need help paying it, do they work with you?
Yeah, absolutely. But here's what the problem is, George. The burden to do that is on the taxpayer. The IRS is never going to call you on the phone. Well, we know they're not going to call you on the phone in any event.
Right.
But they're not going to send you a letter that says, dear taxpayer, we understand that you're having some trouble, and we're a kind and compassionate agency, and we'd like to help you with your problems, so why don't you reach out to us, and we'll help you fix all this. You're not getting that kind of a letter. What's going to happen is if you do nothing, the IRS is going to enforce collection with wage levies, bank levies, and tax liens. You have to be the one to reach out. You have to be the one to take affirmative action. You got to step up. You got to jump through the hoops. You got to make the proposals. And if you don't know how to do it, well, guess what? You're just going to be out of luck.
Amazing. Amazing. The book's, of course, How to Get Tax Amnesty and also IRS Problem Solver, still available for folks.
Yeah, absolutely. They're available at my website, which is taxhelponline.com. It's all one word, no spaces of any kind, taxhelponline.com. And I'll tell you this, George, for your listeners, if they order a book off my website, you're going to get a free 15-minute consultation directly with me personally. So just order the book off my site, taxhelponline.com, and you can talk to me personally about your situation.
Cindy in Ohio, welcome to the program. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, great to see you. Hear from you, George, and talk to you. Hey, listen, I was wondering, Dan, do you know about the Tax Justice Network headquartered out of London, England?
No, I've never heard of them.
What is that, Cindy?
They're called the Tax Justice Network. They produced a video called The Price We Pay, and it's about tax havens and shell companies. And it's, I think it's just right up your alley. And I contacted them, and they're amazing. I have an issue with Bank of America, which has nothing to do with taxes, but it kind of goes to the heart of all of this. I wanted to put that out there about the Tax Justice Network and the work they're doing all over the world looking at tax havens and shell companies. And apparently this was started by Great Britain, and London is a nation state, I guess, like the Vatican and Washington, D.C., but apparently all the money in the world runs through London. So it's truly amazing. And you know, it's not exactly what you're talking about, but I think it's something that you would be interested in. So I wanted to try to call in and share that with you, if that's okay.
Of course it's okay. Sure.
All right, I appreciate that.
What percent of people out there are committing scams against the government?
Well, are we talking about percentage of tax cheaters, George? Is that what
you're
putting at? Well, here's the reality. But the fact of the matter is the vast majority of American citizens do their level best to pay the taxes they owe in full and on time. Now, we've got millions of people, George. At last count, it's roughly 25 million people, plus or minus, that have some kind of a tax delinquency with the IRS where they can't pay the taxes they owe. These people are not cheaters, all right? These people are in trouble through no fault of their own. They got behind through some circumstance, life threw a curveball of some kind that put them in the position where they had to make a choice between paying their taxes and feeding their families. All right, they got behind because of adverse financial circumstances, not because they're tax cheaters. So we got to cut those folks out. Most of those people just they aren't cheaters. The fact of the matter is 98% of every federal dollar collected is collected through some kind of quote-unquote voluntary payment. I don't like to use the word voluntary because the tax system's not voluntary. They got a gun at your head. But the point is that the money is paid in without the IRS having to resort to enforcement action to get it. Only 2% of the revenue that's collected by the IRS every year is collected through enforcement action. All right, and even the enforcement action is carried out against people who, by and large, are not tax cheaters. They're just simply broke and they're behind on their taxes. So the truth of the matter is that the vast majority of people are not cheating on their taxes. The problem, George, is this. We got a tax code that consists of 4 million words,
jeez,
that was changed more than 5,900 times just since 2001 alone, and that doesn't even count all of the changes that were made by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. The tax code is in a constant state of flux. It is completely overwhelming for most people. Over 80% of American taxpayers use some kind of a tax professional to help them prepare their tax returns. So people don't have any idea what this law is, and they have no clue whether they're doing it right or wrong. And if they do something wrong, it's not because they're cheating in the vast majority of cases. It's because they don't know.
That's true. I mean, do the CPAs keep up on this stuff? Because I got to tell you, I couldn't do it on my own. I have to go to somebody else. It's too complicated.
Well, do CPAs keep up on it? Well, it depends on the CPA. It's like anything else, George. There are good CPAs that are conscientious and determined to do a good job, and there are CPAs that are lazy, just like every other profession out there.
Well, that's absolutely true. Dan, so for people who want to get a hold of you, what do?
They go to taxhelponline.com. It's all one word, no spaces. Taxhelponline.com. And again, the book, How to Get Tax Amnesty or the IRS Problem Solver, available on the website along with my other materials. And if you order a book off the site, you can talk to me directly. You can make an appointment, and we'll talk directly about your situation. That's taxhelponline.com.
Taxes are due in 2 months. If you can't get your act together, you can get an extension.
Yeah, absolutely. You can get an extension to file. And one of the things I talk about in the book, George, is the extension of time to actually pay your taxes.
All right, that's great. Dan, thank you. Keep in touch with us, my friend.
I'll do it. Thanks for having me, George.
Super. Up next, angels, reincarnation, and some other things tied into the strange and supernatural in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Marilyn Hughes, who's back with us on Coast to Coast with her latest work, The Hammer of Mysticism. We shall be back.